Hey, everybody. This is Brian. Before we get started this week, we wanted to give a shout-out to Mike Brown and Jay Consalvi. Mike and Jay are the guys who told us about the organization you'll hear from next, the EOD Warrior Foundation. EOD stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal. It's the military way of saying the bomb squad. Mike and Jay are both Navy fighter pilots who've flown hundreds of combat missions, but they host a bike ride each year to raise funds in support of the EODs. When we asked why, Mike and Jay said, quote, "Because those guys had a harder war than just about anybody." In this episode, we'll explain who the EODs are and the life-saving work they do. We'll also introduce you to one former EOD who's doing some incredible work to help vets from every branch of service. Thanks for the nomination, Mike and Jay. We'll be sending you some CGT swag in return. And to everyone else out there listening, we want to hear from you. If you know of an organization we should profile on the show, let us know by emailing us at hello@crazygoodturns.org. As always, thanks for listening.
Right now, somebody's laying on their belly in Yemen or Africa or Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, disarming a bomb to save other people's lives. It's a group of quiet professionals and possibly the most humble.
This is Ken Falk. He served as an EOD technician for most of his 21-year career in the Navy. It's hard to think of a more dangerous job than being a military EOD. The acronym stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal, and it's the military's way of saying the bomb squad. A short list of their jobs includes disarming bombs, working with improvised explosives or IEDs from terrorists, finding and removing landmines, and stopping chemical or even nuclear weapons and making them safe. If you've seen the 2008 movie The Hurt Locker, then you have some idea of what an EOD's work is like. Anyway, here's Ken again.
I had heard once that we had issued over 2,500 Purple Hearts in the EOD community, and that's in a force, an active duty force that averages a strength size of about 7,000 people. So that's almost a third of the force that's been injured in one way or another.
Today, Ken is the chairman of the EOD Warrior Foundation. It's an organization that stands ready to serve the roughly 7,000 EODs on active duty in the military, helping them and their families deal with the physical and emotional toll of the war. It also helps former EODs navigate life after the service. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell inspiring stories about people who do amazing things for others. I'm your host, Brian Sabin. Before we go into the work that Ken and his team are doing at EOD Warrior, it's worth explaining how Ken got here.
I grew up in a great family. I wasn't raised in poverty. I wasn't beaten, tortured, molested, any of the things that happen to a lot of children in our world. But I did lose my mom. My mom died when I was 7 years old. She was 29. She had a rare form of liver cancer. And the last 2 years of her life, she was in and out of comas. And I can remember sitting by her bedside, and somebody said to me one time that you started your training for this mission, you know, when you were 7 years old, to sit next to people's beds and help them.
Long before Ken discovered what his mission is, he was just a kid living in the aftermath of trauma, trying to find his way forward. He was an avid hockey player early on in life and pursued his dream of making it to the NHL.
My goal in life was to play professional ice hockey. It didn't work out for me. I spent a year with a team down in Texas after I got out of high school and probably should have gone to college to get some more experience, but I wanted to go right to the big leagues. It didn't work out for me, and I ended up joining the Navy. I had some anger issues, I think, at the time. My life wasn't going the way I wanted it to, and I wanted to do something cool and be of value to the country, and I actually enlisted in the Navy to be a Navy SEAL. Never wore glasses in my life, but when I got to boot camp, I failed the eye test, and I was talking to the SEAL Chief Petty Officer, who was the recruiter in Orlando, and he said, "Well, why don't you go EOD?" And I said, "Well, what's that?" And he said, "It's bomb disposal." And I said, "Well, that sounds dangerous." And he said, "It is. I wouldn't do it either."
But a few years into active duty, Ken had a change of heart. He met some other EODs while on a deployment and felt a kinship with them.
I had one chief petty officer, EOD guy, who was one of my mentors early on in my career, and he thought that this was the perfect job for me, so I volunteered and went and took all the tests and passed them, and next thing I knew, I was in EOD school.
As you can imagine, learning to disarm bombs involves a lot of training. It's at least a year before you can actually do the work in the field. Ken graduated, and he served as a technician throughout the 80s and 90s, including combat deployments in the first Gulf War and Bosnia.
What I'll tell you is the scariest thing in this profession is dealing with stuff that's buried, when you can't see it, because that brings in a whole nother element of, not surprise, but of basically of being able to uncover this threat. I can remember I was in Bosnia. I can remember laying on my belly in the middle of the night probing for landmines in the ground. And I kept thinking, you know, what if I'm not probing deep enough? What if my probe hits the top of the landmine? It's like those are the kind of things that I think really kind of scare me. And then a lot of my friends who have spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, when you ask them that kind of question, they'll tell you things like driving down the road because the bad guys were hiding these big roadside bombs and piles of trash and burying them under the road and culverts and places where you couldn't see them. And when you ask an EOD guy, normally it wasn't the ordnance that scared him. It was just driving down the road, not knowing what was around the next turn.
But it was a non-combat deployment that really changed the course of Ken's life.
In 1990, I got a great opportunity to go through British IED training. And at the time, it was referred to as their Northern Ireland training course. As you know, the Northern Ireland fight was a lot of IEDs as well. The IRA was blowing up British targets and British soldiers with improvised devices. And that war went over a 25-year period of sophistication from very crude booby traps and IEDs to some very sophisticated things towards the end of their conflict. I went to work for a boss who put me in a job that said, listen, I don't want you worrying about today's problems. I want you to look out in the future and figure out what the problems are going to be for us. And what I found was that we kind of knew the conventional side and even the chemical and biological and nuclear side pretty well. But what we didn't know was the terrorist side, the improvised side, very well. At the time, IED training for American EOD troops was 9 days, and that's it. And our one-year curriculum at the EOD school, it was 9 days. There were a couple of advanced courses you could take afterwards, but the basic training was only 9 days.
Ken says he spent years trying to change the approach, but began to feel stuck.
I truthfully thought if I got out, maybe I could do something different and have a different level of influence, and it turned out I was right.
Ken's Navy career came to an end in 2002, just as the War on Terror was beginning. And while he'd officially left the military, he never left the work or the EOD community behind. His company, AT Solutions, originally trained people on how to disarm weapons of mass destruction, like large-scale nuclear or chemical weapons. But by 2003, the Iraq War made it clear that dealing with improvised explosives, or IEDs, like the roadside bombs that were blowing up Humvees, was going to be the way of the future.
I started a small counterterrorism company. We focused primarily early on in weapons of mass destruction. And then I had the Secretary of Defense once tell me that our company was a national asset. And I was briefing a very high-level person in the Pentagon, and he said to me afterwards, he said, I need 50 guys just like you in Iraq tomorrow. We ended up winning a big contract to train deploying soldiers and Marines primarily. And I think at the height of the war, we were training about 45,000 deploying troops a year. We were very proud of what we did. We did it well. We built realistic training devices so people could see the threats based on intelligence that was gathered on the battlefield before they ever got to theater. So they knew the types of IEDs to be looking for. Somebody said to me one time, I don't know if you'll ever know how many lives you actually saved.
But Ken's professional success came at personal costs. The global war on terror has exacted a tremendous toll on all branches of the U.S. military, but it's been especially hard on EOD technicians.
We've had 135 EOD troops killed since 9/11, which was about how many we'd had killed since World War II when the profession started. So it's been a tough, tough war on the EOD family in general. We've had hundreds. I don't know the exact number. We think it's around 225 men and women severely injured. That's limb loss, paralysis, blinded by improvised devices, severe burns over the majority of their body.
Ken is intimately familiar with the costs borne by active duty EODs. As a Virginia resident, he's within driving distance of Walter Reed Hospital, and he's went there many times to support wounded service members returning home.
Early on in the Iraq War, I got a call from a friend of mine. We were instructors together at the EOD school, and he called me and said one of his soldiers had lost his legs. And would I meet him, because I live about an hour outside of D.C., would I meet him at Walter Reed Hospital? I said I'd be honored to. We got to the hospital, and my wife and I, and there was this young guy laying there with no legs. Really the first time in my career I'd seen it. I said, what can we do to help? Where's your mom? And his mom didn't have any money, and she was trying to figure out how to get her dog watched and get enough money to get from her home to the hospital. And anyway, my wife and I ended up paying for his mom to get up there. I called her on the phone, and I was outside the room, and I said, listen, I said, your son needs you here, like, immediately. early on in the war, the government wasn't paying for family travel to the hospital. And I was like in shock. I just couldn't believe it when I heard this. And as a veteran of the first Gulf War, I figured, hell, this thing will be over in 3 months anyway. And, you know, hopefully this will be the first and last guy we see like that. It was early in the year. And that year, we did what we did. Not only my wife and I's personal money, but our company's money at AT Solutions, did that 11 more times.
Ken says that those trips cost him or his company between $3,000 and $10,000 each time. And it became clear that the needs weren't going to go away. They were only growing larger.
From about May of 2010 till early 2013, we had 71 amputees. And on average, I was going to the hospital to meet a new family probably every week or week and a half. So it was a lot in a very short period of time, and most of them were coming from Afghanistan. We had changed our tactics in Afghanistan and gone from mounted to dismounted operations, heavy dismounted operations, and a lot of guys were finding IEDs with their legs and feet stepping on them.
Ken turned his efforts into a full-fledged nonprofit to help wounded EODs, and he later merged it with an existing group to form the EOD Warrior Foundation. The group has four missions. First, it helps families bridge the gap between what the government can provide a wounded veteran and what his or her needs really are.
I'll paint you a quick picture of maybe a scenario that makes this very complex. If you have a Marine stationed in Camp Pendleton, San Diego, California, deployed to Afghanistan, and he gets injured, gets medevaced back to Washington, D.C., his wife and children and dogs and cats are in San Diego, his parents are in Seattle, and his wife's parents are in Florida. And all of a sudden, everybody's lives are disrupted. People losing jobs and having to quit jobs and finding places to pull dogs while the wife and the children can come back, and dogs and cats while the wife and children can come back to see their loved ones in the hospital. It's a complicated problem. And it's organizations like ours that raise the money to try to alleviate as much of that financial burden.
The EOD Warrior Foundation also provides scholarships to the children of EOD families. That's mission number two. Mission three is maintaining a memorial wall at Eglin Air Force Base, paying homage to those whose lives were lost. But Ken says the EOD Warrior Foundation's fourth mission is its hardest.
And what we call Hope and Wellness Retreats is kind of our fourth mission. We have determined through a series of meetings with probably the most sophisticated people in the suicide business in the world that suicide really is a disease of hopelessness. And the saddest thing that breaks my heart and where I focus most of my time today is that we've had almost the same number of suicide deaths since 9/11 as we have battlefield injuries. And I think that is an indicator of a lot of things, but primarily severe stress that massive, long-term, multiple deployments take a toll on us. I always tell people, you know, people go to war and do bad things to bad people, and that is normally against the moral and ethical way that most of us are raised. And a lot of times that stuff sits heavy on you. And you see bad things, even if you don't shoot and kill somebody yourself, you see a lot of bad things on the battlefield. It's like dead bodies and not the kind, you know, things that your brain, the average brain, is conditioned to in modern times to have to witness.
Ken has invested a lot of himself into the fight against suicide and hopelessness. Not long into the war on terror, Ken took land on his property, and he turned it into a retreat center for veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
We ended up bringing lots of these EOD families out to our house. We did barbecues and weekend stays and had a couple people stay with me for a week, and we really got to know the EOD community well and some of the needs that these families had. And we ended up donating 37 acres of our estate, and we built the nation's first dedicated retreat center for military and veteran wellness, primarily initially as a respite center where families could come and get away from this free of charge and take care of themselves.
The retreat center takes a unique approach to combating PTSD.
Historically, PTSD treatment really was focused on kind of the Vietnam generation. And as we know, generations are different in people, and this generation wasn't responding well to the treatments. And I said, well, you know, what are we going to do to fix it? I ended up meeting a lot of really cool people in this field that had years and years of experience, from Dr. Benson up at Harvard to Dr. Okenberg, who actually led the team that did the PTSD diagnosis back in 1980. Most importantly, who I met, who I really got to love, is a guy named Dr. Rich Tedeschi, who had studied this whole science of post-traumatic growth. And the underlying meaning of that is what doesn't kill us can make us stronger. I said, you know, I really kind of understand that you've studied these families, but, you know, have you ever done anything with the military? And he said, yeah, we had studied prisoners of war from the Vietnam War. And I said, well, what'd you find out? And he said, 30% of Vietnam veterans came home from war with PTSD, which arguably, depending on which statistics you believe, is what's happening with this generation. It's about 30% of the force that's deployed. And he said, how many prisoners of war do you think came back with PTSD? And I said, maybe 100%. And he said, no. Tedeschi said, no, it wasn't 100%. It was only 4% of prisoners of war. And I said, well, how could that be? And he talked about, you know, the leader in the prison camps, and specifically the Hanoi Hilton, was a guy named James Stockdale, who at the time was a commander. He was a senior officer in the prison camps and ended up retiring as an admiral. And Stockdale was a stoic, and he was a great human being, and he had really built a sense of hope into these troops. And what I tell people today is that when I look at guys and gals with PTSD, I'm convinced that this is as much of a leadership problem as it is a mental health problem.
Today, Ken is trying to teach veterans how to achieve post-traumatic growth. In addition to his work for the EOD community, his Boulder Crest Foundation is open to veterans from all branches of the military. And while the programs they teach involve a lot of factors, Ken says that you can boil many of them down into two main concepts.
One is to have these regulation practices, that when things are going wrong, can I stop? Can I breathe? Can I go on a run? Can I go play a game of golf? Go fishing? Whatever it is that makes you self-regulate before you just negatively react to these situations, that's the first key ingredient. And there's a lot of ways to self-regulate. And we have this saying that if you don't self-regulate, you tend to self-medicate. The other line that holds us into this ability to what we would say struggle well is relationships. And as human beings, we do in fact thrive on relationships, on quality relationships. If you have toxic relationships in your life, you got to get them out. You cannot isolate. You can't thrive in an isolated environment. So it may be the only way you survive is to pack up your stuff and move to the mountains of Wyoming or Montana. But if you don't have positive relationships, it's just going to be very difficult to live a life of post-traumatic growth. So what we try to get everybody to understand is that as humans, we tend to become the average of the 3 to 5 people we spend the most time with, and for people to get 3 to 5 healthy people in their lives.
Ken says he relies on these principles himself. They help him deal with his own anxieties and what ifs.
I question myself, did I get out of the military sometimes too soon? Could I have done more in the military to help with better training and better equipment, or did I do just as good a job outside? I do question myself on that sometimes, but I also take care of myself too. I meditate, I exercise, I do the things that I tell people they need to do to be able to regulate themselves so that we don't have to fall into massive depression and anxiety issues.
The work of helping EOD warriors returning with massive physical wounds has ebbed off from its peak a few years ago, but it still continues on. During our conversation, Ken mentioned a chief petty officer who was recently made a quadriplegic due to injuries that he suffered. It's Ken's goal to ensure that all of those EODs and their families receive all the support that they need.
We're not a huge foundation. We raise a couple $1 million a year and give most of it away. And what we don't give away, we've been putting away into an endowment, because I keep telling, you know, everybody that I don't want to walk away from this, and at some point in time, I will retire, but I don't want to walk away from this and leave a situation where somebody has to do what we did, which was start from zero. And our endowments recently crossed about $3.5 million, and, you know, our goal is to try to get that up to about $10 million.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our podcast. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about the EOD Warrior Foundation. We'll also have a link there where you can donate. You can submit ideas for other people or organizations we should feature on an upcoming episode by emailing us at hello@crazygoodturns.org. Stay connected with us between shows by following us on Facebook or Twitter at @crazygoodturns. Our show is audio engineered by Stephen Key. Music supervision and mixing by Score in Los Angeles. A special thanks to Megan Basinger. I'm your host, Brian Sabin.
There's a lot of charities that are doing great things. Resources are limited, but this is a community that deserves to be taken care of, as all do, and it's a community that's seen a lot of trauma, and we're working hard just to make sure we can do our part to help.